Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
Today's show is brought to you by my patrons on Patreon. And if you're a patron, you are awesome. Thank you. Thanks for supporting me and allowing me to be a full-time activist to dedicate all of my efforts to the defeat of these damaging superstitious ideas via the radio show and the videos I produce and the speeches I give around the country and beyond. The patrons are huge. And if you are not a patron and you would like to be one, it really does. It makes a major difference, and it really is something I'm hugely grateful for. You can decide how much you want to pledge or be a patron for. You can determine all the parameters. It's your party, right? You just decide. You can go to patreon.com/SethAndrews, and thank you so much for your support. There was a little meme or poster flying around the internet. We see these types of things all the time on Facebook, especially. And it had a picture of planet Earth against a black backdrop, and it said this. It said, "If you could rid the world of one thing, what would it be?" And of course, people are probably thumbing through their mental Rolodex to find out, well, if I can get rid of one thing on planet Earth, what would it be? Several people would say religion. But, you know, what would your answer be? And I actually went ahead and responded, "If I could rid the world of one thing, what would it be?" I couldn't limit it to just one, so I listed five. I said, "I'd like to rid the world of hunger, disease, tyranny, superstition, and guacamole." Guacamole is not food, okay? It's just not. It's not pleasant to look at. It's not good to taste. Guacamole. I think the planet would be better off without it. Well, you would have thought I would have insulted somebody's firstborn child on social media. I mean, the outrage brigade was all over me. So someone now I realize that you really can't be wrong in stating a preference when it comes to food. I get that, but you're wrong. Guacamole is not food. No food should look like that. I mean, wouldn't the world be a better place without it? If you go and you're at a Mexican restaurant and they bring you chips, and next to the chips, there's a cup of white queso with bacon bits in it. And next to it is a cup of guacamole. It's no contest. No contest. It's the queso. The guacamole. You can remove the guacamole from the table, from the restaurant. You can put it in the parking lot, and you have not in any way diminished your dining experience. This means that guacamole makes no contribution to humanity, in my opinion. Now, as I sit here in the studio, I'm sure the pro-guacamole brigade is circling my house with torches. Maybe I've missed it. Maybe I've missed the point. Maybe I need to go back and give it another shot. Just saying. I thought it was a good answer. Five things to rid the world of: hunger, disease, tyranny, superstition, guacamole. That, to me, is a strong five. Whatever. This is very much an off-the-cuff show. It's funny, I just finished this one speech. I'm touring with it through the fall, but I'm getting ready for a two-event weekend in Los Angeles. It's the OCLA Symposium, and it's like Saturday, the 12th of August is in Fullerton, California, and then Sunday we're going to be in Los Angeles. And so Bruce Gleason, the organizer, said, "Hey, Seth, could you do a separate speech? Could you bring new material for Sunday in case we get some crossover, in case some people want to go to Saturday and then come out to Sunday and it won't be redundant?" So here I am. I got to come up with new material. So I'm putting together a new speech, and I was going to just dedicate all my time to that, but I hate to skip a broadcast if I don't have to. And I know many of the listeners enjoy listening and like to have that in their podcast feed every Tuesday and And so I thought, well, what the hell? Let's just open the microphone and without any real preparation, unlike last week, which was a meticulously prepared show. Seth Andrews teaches Sunday school, where we went through some of the lesser known, the more obscure stories in the Bible. I mean, that took a lot of time to put together. You may not realize how much time some radio shows actually take if you format them a certain way. But for me, at least, it just takes a long time because I want to make sure that I'm respecting the time of the listeners. And then there's days like today where I don't have much of a plan at all. I've got some messages in my inbox. There's some headlines. There's just some things on my mind. But, you know, we're not going to change the world today. This is just something to listen to. So if this is your kind of show, then great. I'm glad you're here. Hope you enjoy. If it's not your kind of broadcast, nothing personal. If you check out, I'll catch you next week. Okay. What's on my mind today? What have I been thinking about today? Truthfully, honestly, I'm thinking about Rat Dog today. Now, those of you who know me and know my show, you are already familiar with my sort of unofficial mascots. It's Henry and Rat Dog. Rat Dog's real name is Tootsie, but I called her Rat Dog. 3.5 pounds, both of them. Henry's a rescue, and Tootsie was Natalie's dog when we met. And I used to make fun of these little, one of her friends on her tennis team calls them hairdresser dogs. You know, dogs you can put in a shoebox, dogs so small that if you were to put them inside some of these canine kennels, you know, that you get, these little houses for dogs, they could actually slip out through the bars. Yeah, that's how small they are. And, of course, both of these animals have stolen my heart. Well, I'm kind of worried about Rat Dog. She's acting kind of funny. Now, I realize that we're all getting older. This life is finite, and we are changing every day, slowly changing as we head toward the end of the journey. What was it that Christopher Hitchens once said? He said, no one beats these odds. Like, we all know that all lives, whether it's the human animal or the canine animal, all lives eventually come with the death sentence. We know that. I'm not trying to be morbid. I'm just saying we know that life is finite. It's temporary. Well, Rat Dog's 10. She's just over 10 years old. She's doing all right. One major surgery. She had an ACL fixed on her right leg. Now the left leg is starting to do the same stuff. These small dogs have what's called a floating patella, meaning the kneecap can't properly seat on the leg because the little groove there is too shallow. These dogs are so small that the kneecaps just float right off, and it makes it hard to walk, and she's getting worse. So now she's kind of gimping around the house, and she goes outside and she kind of tips over. I mean, it's not funny, but I mean, she's just not navigating like she used to. And so now we're having that discussion. Do we ante up and put her through the surgery and the recovery, which was pretty intense the first time around? Do we do that to her, thinking she'll get another 5 years of goodness out of this life? Or do we just, you know, if she's not in pain, do we wait? So our inclination is, let's just wait. Let's keep a close eye on her. I mean, it's tough. It's a tough decision. She's got a little bit of cataracts going on, so I think she's starting to lose a little bit of her vision. And she's doing some odd stuff. Like, I'll feed the dogs. Normally, once I feed them, they go off and do their respective thing, or we let them outside, or she goes back to her kennel or whatever. But now, Rat Dog's just standing. Like, she'll just go to a little part of a room and just stand. She's not staring at the door. She's not staring at me. She's not staring at the television. She's not staring at cat or anything that's moving. She's just sort of staring off into the abyss. Let her out front. She'll kind of walk a little bit, and then she'll just stop. She doesn't sit. She doesn't look like she's looking at anything. She just is. And I'll go over, and all of a sudden she registers me, and I pick her up and carry her inside. What's that about? What's going on? Yeah, we had her eyes checked. Yeah, we've had her checked overall. She seems to be doing okay. She's just starting to act weird. I need these dogs to live forever, man. I need them to invent the technology that allows the animals to live forever. I need this. Or at least as long as I do. Like, my heart can't take the idea of losing. That's how attached I have become. If I'm on the road, if I'm out doing a speech and Natalie's on Skype, I'm like, turn the camera around so I can see the dogs. Oh, that's your little puppy's got to miss you so much. That's me. Okay, that's me. One of my favorite Rat Dog stories. And don't judge me, but I occasionally will go out and get them ice cream. Like if I go through a drive-thru of some kind, the dogs know that only goodness comes out of a drive-thru. Like if you pull around a drive-thru, you see them both at full attention, eyes wide, ears perked. They are ready for the goodness to come through the window. Whatever it is, it's going to be good. And so sometimes we'll go out and get like a frozen yogurt or we'll get some ice cream or something. And they have these little pup cups. And so I was by myself and I had both dogs in the passenger seat. And I know this is wrong. I know I shouldn't have done it. But I was driving back and I had the little cone in my right hand as I was driving home. And Rad Dog was standing sort of on the little median between the seats and she was licking the ice cream. She's enjoying herself. Henry had a little cup right next to her on the seat. Well, I don't know. Something jumped out in front of the car. And for some reason, I had to slam on the brakes. I had to slam on the brakes. So Rad Dog's face is right next to the cone. I mean, right on top of it. And so when I hit the brakes, it was like, blah! She just went just head first into this wall of ice cream. And she pulls her head back out and she just looks like the abominable snowman. I mean, and of course, I am howling with laughter and I feel terrible at the same time. So I'm wiping her face off. She's trying to lick her own face, you know, that kind of thing. I don't know. It's hard to watch the those we love getting older. The price we pay, right? The price we pay for love is the potential loss of those we care about. If I may be a little bit dramatic there. What else has been going on in my world? I saw a couple of really good movies over the past week that you might be interested in. Maybe you've already seen them. It's actually been a really good summer for movies. Have you noticed? I mean, there have been very few dogs out there. I mean, Transformers, that was an easy one to just scratch off the list. I mean, you lose me in the trailer right when it says a Michael Bay film. You totally lost me. Like, I know I can save my 10, 12, whatever dollars. I know. I can just save that money. I can go somewhere else. I know that. And so I'd been reading some very good reviews about a film called The Big Sick. No idea what it was about. I mean, none. I didn't know who was in it. I didn't know what the storyline was. I had no clue, except I saw that it was extremely, extremely well reviewed, and they say it's really good. So without any primer, I decided to just get a couple of tickets and just go in cold. And just be totally surprised. I mean, you get a ticket for War of the Planet of the Apes, which was the other film we saw, and you get a pretty good idea what you're in for. But The Big Sick, I'm like, what are they talking about? What is it? Is it like slapstick? They say it's funny. Is it a romantic comedy? Is it something else? Is it locker room humor? I don't know what to expect. We went in, and it's a beautiful little movie. It is a beautiful little movie. It took me about 20 minutes to engage, but when I did, I was all in. And it probably resonated with me because, and I'm not giving any spoilers away here, but ultimately the film is a commentary about, you know, the human conditions and love and relationships and the cultures that we come from that can either unite or divide us. And there's a lot of sort of text and subtext about familial expectation. What is your family think you ought to do? What do they expect you to do? How do they expect you to live your life? What are the consequences if you say, no, I'm not going to do it? Well, as an apostate, I mean, my story is much different than the one portrayed on screen, but there were some real crossover there. I mean, this is true. I blocked my father on my cell phone. I put a post about it up online. I wasn't looking for sympathy. I was just venting a little bit. But when you have a retired theologian parent, scratch that. When you have two, when you have two retired theologian parents and they have all kind of time on their hands and you are sort of off the reservation, well, how do they fill the day? Okay. What do they do with their time? Apparently, I am their hobby. Like, they just sit around and send emails and texts and create arguments and discussions, and it just goes nowhere. Now, that's been going on for 10 years, and I don't mean to drive you crazy with it. It's just so front and center. It's so front burner in my life. It just spills out of me. It just comes out when I'm talking about things. And I've sort of gone through a series of phases in terms of response. Like, how do I respond this time? Or how do I respond? Do I respond at all? And there's an ebb and flow to it. It's a roller coaster. Sometimes it's really intense, and then sometimes we don't really talk at all. I think we went for a period of well over a year, maybe a year and a half, and didn't really have any interaction at all. I skipped the holidays, didn't go to Christmas. And, you know, who wants to go when you're just going to be surrounded with judgment and being shamed, and you're an embarrassment to the family? Even when they don't say it, it's being communicated all the time. And I'm always giving the advice about boundaries. Boundaries, boundaries. You should set boundaries in your life. You get to determine the effect of your life. You get to determine who you are and what your goals are and who you love and what you want to pursue and what your value system is and your own pursuit of the evidence and truth. That belongs to you and no one else gets to guide it. I'm great at giving that advice. I'm really not great at taking it. Because many times I'm like the battered partner. I just keep going back, thinking, well, maybe this time we can have a relationship. So out of the blue, I get another series of texts. And in the past, I've tried arguing data and facts and the evidence. Well, that doesn't work. And I've tried pointing out specific stuff in the Bible. That doesn't work. I've really tried the whole, hey, go live your life and I'll live mine. I respect your right to believe my life belongs to me. I've tried that. And so this most recent volley, I decided I was going to respond with humor. Now, not the kind of humor that Dad would really laugh at, but the kind of humor that I would laugh at. Like, if I'm going to get the texts, I might as well just have some fun. You know, if they're going to not stop bothering me, I guess I can turn it into an opportunity for self-amusement. And so this is probably a bad idea. Out of the blue, this retiree with a shit ton of time on his hands sends me another barrage of scriptures about God and prophecy and judgment and Jesus and heaven and hell and all that. And I didn't say anything, I don't think, or maybe I said something about how awesome Jesus was. I sent him a meme I saw on the internet. It's a screenshot of Willem Dafoe from The Last Temptation of Christ. He's Jesus Christ. He has a big crown of thorns stuck on his head. And the caption underneath said, "Look, Dad, I'm a cactus." Now, I enjoy Jesus. I enjoy making fun of Jesus. I enjoy making fun of the devil. I enjoy making fun of the sacred. For me, the stuff that used to just terrify me and the stuff I thought was off limits and it controlled my life, these are the things I like to make fun of the most. Because it's my way of defying the control that they tried to exert over me. Jesus watching you in your life, knowing your thoughts, judging you, requiring the prayers for forgiveness of sin whenever you fell short, which was pretty much every 5 minutes, those types of things. Well, now you can turn around. And I mean, if you read my book, Sacred Cows, I did a whole chapter on the Philippine guys who self-crucify every freaking Easter. You know, we've got like Jesus gift shops depicted. Vincent DePorter was my illustrator. We got Jesus gift shop selling crucifixion nails, and we've got Jesus hanging on the cross. And, you know, we've got all these sort of sacrilegious illustrations in that particular chapter. And I think that's hugely liberating. My father, not so much. I mean, terrified at the idea that his son makes fun of Jesus. And so he sends me another barrage of scriptures. I sent him the next Jesus meme. It's Jesus praying by himself right before the crucifixion. And the caption says, "Hey, God, it's me, you." No response to that. I get another barrage of scriptures. I think if I remember right, I sent him the one of Jesus being the hide-and-seek champion of the world. Jesus covers his eyes with his hands, but the nail holes allow him to see perfectly. I think I sent him that one. I thought it was funny. I almost sent him the one where Jesus is hanging on the cross. And the caption says, "Not going anywhere, try a Snickers." I almost sent him that one, but I didn't do it. And it just went on. "Dad, please stop. Dad, please stop. Dad, Dad, please stop. Please stop." I blocked him. I just blocked him. From my text, from my calls, from my email. You know? I just had enough. You ever feel that way? I've had enough. I'm tired. And I think the part that bothers me the most is the fact that it didn't really bother me. I have no idea what that's about. It's, you know, in the past when we've come to this point of impasse or we've had these exchanges and it's come to a head, and my father, he sends me notes that tell me that in my work, I crucify Jesus every day. And I am persecuting Jesus. And I'm like, how can a completely all-powerful God feel persecuted? How does that happen? He's God. Nothing harms him. There is no kryptonite for Jesus. And so one guy on the internet, one pithy human on the internet, is persecuting him somehow, and Dad's all up in arms about it. It makes no sense. The whole of Christianity makes no sense. The ideas that families divide over this nonsense makes no sense. And I just blocked him. Blocked him outright. I don't know how long it'll last. But I do know that the sensation I felt the most when I blocked him was a lack of sensation. Isn't that weird? Like, I don't have a feeling about it. I don't even really feel the sense of loss. Mostly, I'm just thankful for the peace and quiet. I'm not sitting over here having dinner with my family or watching Game of Thrones or doing whatever, and my phone's dinging, bing, all the time, bing, and I look down. Oh, look, it's Mom. Oh, look, it's Dad. Oh, look, it's Mom and Dad. And it's just a series of platitudes and sermons and all those things. My biggest feeling was that I didn't really feel anything about it. I understand that there is a loss that has taken place, but I've come to this weird moment where I just don't really feel it. I don't know if that's healthy or unhealthy. I don't know if it's good or not good. I don't really know what to do with it. All I know is I flipped it like a little toggle switch, and all of the irritating noises stopped. That's just weird. Now, religion puts you in weird positions, doesn't it? Hell, not just religion. People do it over politics or other types of stuff, right? This isn't how we raised you. Robbing the child of their own mind and saying, you're supposed to be a mini-me. You're supposed to be like me. That's what we raised. And you're not, and it's just wrong. And we're going to drive you crazy about it. Click. Whatever. Didn't mean to get off on that tangent. It's just what was happening. What else has been going on in the world? A little bit of a dust up on social media. A while back, I posted something or reposted something. It was a quote that said, spiritual but not religious. It's an idiom that relates to people who prefer to make up their own stuff rather than believe stuff others have made up. Well, I guess this is kind of a hot topic. Like, I'm not religious. I don't hold a religion, but I am spiritual. Maybe we should do another show and focus more on this question. I mean, religion's in the business of moving the goalposts anyway, often moving the goalposts, so it can't be pinned down. But I think if you say that I'm spiritual, that's even doubly so. I mean, how do you lock that down? You're spiritual, meaning that you hold to a spirit, an actual spiritual plane? Is it a spirit of a person or an animal or something else, a being beyond us we haven't yet seen or discovered but does exist and impacts how we think and how we feel and the human experience? A spirit? You're spiritual? Or do you use spiritual in the context of, this is how I describe some of the quote-unquote transcendent human experiences on Earth, the birth of a newborn child or a beautiful sunset or vista or some amazing occurrence that is so difficult to sum up in words, I just think it's a spiritual experience. It's a way of describing what happens in the physical world, but it doesn't necessarily attach itself to spirits or ghosts or whatever. The root of the word spiritual being spirit, if you tell a believer, hey, I'm an atheist, but I'm spiritual. Now, how do they process that? Wait, you are a non-believer in the supernatural, but you're invoking spirits. And so maybe we should do a show on this. Maybe we should have a conversation about this. Do you have thoughts on spiritual but not religious? Like, are you a spiritual person? And do you mean it in the literal context? Like, I don't believe in gods, but I think I believe in spirits. And there are some people who are atheists. They don't believe in God or gods, but they believe in ghosts. Ghosts being spirits, so they would be atheists, but also spiritual, I guess, in that context. I find it a fascinating conversation. It's a little bit frustrating, too, because, again, it's so subjective, and it's so individually defined, and it's so difficult to pin down. I also find that a lot of the people who are sort of drifting in a deistic valley, so to speak, they use spiritual but not religious as a way of holding on to religion. They don't have to actually cut the cord. They don't have to make any hard decisions. They can simply say, and this is just some people, they can simply say, oh, I'm not religious, meaning I don't hold to the dogma. I'm not a judgmental person. I don't believe in magic in this context, but I am spiritual. And that's their way of sort of participating in the religion game without having to actually attach themselves to a team. I find that frustrating. But, you know, maybe there's some merit. There are people like Greta Vosper, and I think Sam Harris has used the word spiritual in a certain context. What do you think about it? Are you spiritual but not religious? Would you find that an interesting subject to discuss down the way? We might have to tackle it. Somebody sent me a message and said, why beer is better than Jesus. Oh, this is going to be good. Why beer is better than Jesus? Number one, you can prove you have a beer. Number two, if you devote your life to beer, there are groups to help you stop. Number three, nobody has ever been burned at the stake, hanged, or tortured over their brand of beer. Number four, you don't have to wait 2,000 years for a second beer. Number five, no one will kill you for not drinking a beer. Number six, when you have a beer, you don't go knocking on other people's doors to give it away. And number seven, beer won't tell you how to have sex. And they got a point. Beer, better than Jesus. You know what? I should have sent the why beer is better than Jesus to my dad. It's a missed opportunity. Denver Post published an article just this month, and I'm not making this up. It says, these Coloradans say Earth is flat and that gravity is a hoax, and now they're being persecuted. Now, when I first saw this, I figured it was something posted or published by David Avocado Wolf, right? He's the guy who thinks that, you know, gravity is toxic and that mushrooms flew here on the cosmic wind. And I think he said chocolate is an octave of sun energy. Those types of things. You expect that from David Wolf. Well, apparently the flat earth movement is on the rise. This tells us almost everything we need to know about science education in the United States in the 21st century, doesn't it? I mean, not only do we have to deal with the anti-vax crowd, we have now people who are saying that we should distrust science's revelation that the Earth is not flat. Let me just read part of the article from the Denver Post. This was posted on July the 7th by Graham Ambrose. Every Tuesday at 6 p.m., 36 Coloradans from every corner of the state, 36, like only 36, well, that's encouraging, 36 assemble in the windowless back room of a small Fort Collins coffee shop. They have met 16 times since March, most nights talking through the ins and outs of their shared faith, until the owners kick them out at closing. They have no leaders, no formal hierarchy, and no enforced ideology, save a common quest for answers to questions about the stars. Their membership has slowly swelled in the past 3 years, though persecution and widespread public derision keep them mostly underground. Many use pseudonyms or only give first names. They mention the group's founder, John Vinuck, who lives in Fort Collins. He's at the epicenter of a budding movement, one that's coming for your books, movies, God, and mind. They are thousands strong, perhaps one in every 500, and have proponents at the highest levels of science, sports, journalism, and arts. They call themselves flat earthers because they believe Earth, the blue, majestic, spinning orb of life, is as flat as a table. And they want you to know because it's 2017. Vinuck says, this is a new awakening. Some will accept it, some won't, but love it or hate it, you can't ignore flat Earth. Now, lest you think I am crazy or making this up, allow me to share with you the story of a billboard that went up last month in Philadelphia. It made news. It was featured on the CBS affiliate in Philadelphia about a billboard. Sandwiched between two insurance ads, there is a billboard that reads, "Research Flat Earth." The man who purchased the billboard, whose name is Matt Powerland, he says NASA pictures and videos of the curved Earth have been faked, all part of a CGI augmented reality, and the spacewalks were mostly done in desalinated water tanks. Now, who took this guy's money for the billboard? Like, who said, okay, but you got to pay me in cash or in advance, right? Somebody took his money and put the billboard up. Did you guys see that post on Twitter, which apparently was unaware of the irony as it posted that the Flat Earth Society has members all around the globe? I fear for the species. I fear for the species. What else is going on? Catholic Church made the news recently. All the shit that's going on with the Catholic Church. Cardinal Pell finally returning home to Australia to face sexual abuse charges, and it's about damn time. Is that what the church is talking about? No. No, that's not what the church is concerned about. The church is concerned about gluten-free bread being used for communion wafers. That's the crisis which must be immediately addressed. There was an article in the BBC just a few weeks ago. It said this, and I quote, "Bread used to celebrate the Eucharist during Roman Catholic Mass must not be gluten-free, although it can be made from GMOs." Well, that's a relief. In a letter to bishops, Cardinal Robert Serra said the bread can be low gluten, but there must be enough protein in the wheat to make it without additives. They said they needed these new rules because the bread now sold in supermarkets and on the internet is often gluten-free, and this would not please God. They believe in transubstantiation, remember? They believe that at the moment that you put the wafer and the wine in your mouth, they transform into the flesh and blood of Jesus Christ, which is not in the least bit creepy. Oh, cannibalism. Have you seen that meme on the web that says, "Eat Jesus, one cracker at a time"? Well, the wine has to be used from natural fruit of the grape without any impurities and corruptions added. You can't mix the grape juice with other substances. Apparently, God can't transform or won't transform those liquids into his own blood. No, it has to be natural wine. And you can't use gluten-free bread. It has to have gluten in it. You have got to be shitting me. The BBC article said that this ruling was issued at the request of Pope Francis himself. And there are over a billion Catholics on planet Earth who apparently don't think this is insanity. I've mentioned it before. Have you seen they're like little travel packets for communion? It looks like a little coffee creamer packet is what it looks like. In the bottom, it's sealed up wine, and on the top, there's a little wafer. And so these are like portable. So if you go out and do like an outdoor service or an Easter sunrise service, you can just take these. They look like little Coffee Mate packets and you just hand them out. That's flesh and blood. It's the flesh and blood of Jesus Christ, but it is portable. So you can actually practice cannibalism here on location as we commemorate our Savior Jesus Christ. Bizarre. On a more serious note in regard to the Catholic Church, we do need to talk about Cardinal Pell. Cardinal Pell is 76 years old. He's the treasurer of the Catholic Church. He is, I believe, the third most powerful guy in the Catholic Church. And he has returned home to Australia. He hasn't been home. He says he has been over at the Vatican because of health concerns. I'm sure it has nothing to do with the fact that he would be facing sexual abuse charges. But after all this time, he has finally gone home to face charges of sexual abuse. There was an article in Time magazine that said, "Pell's return has inspired mixed feelings among the Catholic faithful. Australia has been the location of some of the global church's worst child sex abuses, with an astonishing 7% of priests in the organization between 1950 and 2009 having been accused of child sex crimes. That's 7 in every 100. It's not much better in the U.S., where researchers found that from 1950 through June 2015, 5.6% of the over 110,000 priests there were accused of child sexual abuse. Wherever it's taken place, the molestation of children has long proved one of the Catholic Church's most damaging and intractable problems. In the States, the church has been embroiled in a series of child sex scandals involving as many as 100,000 victims. In 2007, the Los Angeles Archdiocese paid out $660 million to 508 victims of clerical abuse. And there are serious allegations that Cardinal Pell turned a blind eye and, in fact, helped to facilitate child sexual abuse within the Catholic Church. Serious allegations which deserve a serious response by Cardinal Pell. And again, the Catholic Church sort of shrugs and says, we're just as upset about all this as everybody else is. I mean, institutionalized child abuse, the insulation and protection of abusers from the law, because church law, God's law, is apparently supposed to trump or circumvent the law of the land, the law which protects children. No one's stopping to ask why God would allow a single child to be molested in his house. Nobody's asking the question, at least I haven't been able to find it in these articles. Why isn't time starting the story with, if God exists and he cares about children and he's all powerful, why in the world would he not prevent the rape of a child? Tim Minchin did a brilliant song directed to the Cardinal called Come Home, Cardinal Pell. If you have not sought it out on YouTube, I encourage you to do so as soon as possible. Anyway, Pell's in the hot seat for allegedly covering up abuse committed by priests when he was serving as the Archbishop of Melbourne. That was a period of 6 years, I think, starting in 1996. Pell said his predecessor was guilty. His predecessor, who's dead, by the way, had destroyed documents. He destroyed documents to help protect priests from prosecution. In Australia, they found over 1,800 alleged perpetrators and almost 4,500 different victims coming forward between 1950 and 2015. I mean, come on. Anyway, the public is clamoring. They'd like to see the files. They'd like to know the stories of the victims. They would like to see the church being transparent. Wouldn't that be refreshing? The BBC posted something just a few weeks back. The headline, I cannot believe I'm reading this one. The headline says, Saudi Arabia has, quote, clear link to UK extremism, report says. Do you think? Somebody explain how Saudi Arabia has so often gotten off the hook when we talk about Islamic extremism. How is it that they are a power player at the Human Rights Council, at the UN? How is it that Saudi Arabia is our ally? I mean, how do moral people justify the insanity? I mean, 15 of the 19 9/11 hijackers came from Saudi Arabia, for Pete's sake. Whatever. I talked to Yasmin Muhammad, former Islamist, and she thinks it's all about money. She may have a point. What else is going on? I had a message in from Grant. He sent me an email. He said, have you done an episode on atheists who used to be religious, but still have lingering beliefs that they struggle with? I'm not specifically talking about people who are still afraid of hell. I'm more referring to things like homophobia, sex, interracial marriage, etc. Things that affect how a person interacts with the world or treats other people. Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. I mean, it's baggage, right? I mean, it's stuff that they saddle us with when we are younger and we sort of drag it through our religious lives. And then you come out of religion and you find yourself in many ways sort of dragging these same things around. They've just been with you for so long. You're so used to having them there. They are this big weight on your shoulders that you don't realize is hindering you, is dragging you backward. You mentioned that hell wasn't really what you were talking about, but hell's a great example. I mean, in my logical brain, when I realized I was an atheist, my logical brain knew that hell was total crap. that I didn't buy it. It was obviously a man-made construct used to control people. But, you know, in the middle of the night when I couldn't sleep and I was staring at the ceiling trying to evaluate how much my life had changed and what's going to happen in my career and in my family and all these things, I still in some way was dragging along the baggage of, well, what if I'm wrong? What if I go to hell? I don't want to burn alive forever. It's going to be awful. It's unimaginable pain. And the way I got through it was to make the conscious step away from it and making the decision that, you know, my rational brain is going to overcome the irrational heart. And while I'm a believer in the heart, and I think that emotion is an important and beneficial part of the human experience, I really do. I mean, I think it's okay to feel and to have things resonate in our heart and in our bones. I just don't think emotion leads the train. You know, the church is an emotion-based environment. Right? You go with the flow. It's faith. It's fake it till you make it. You surrender to the spirit kind of stuff. But when you're a rationalist or attempting to be a rationalist, you know, emotion does not go first. So when I'm terrified of hell, I can make the conscious choice that, you know what? I'm not going to accept hell, the premise of hell pitched by the pastors and the pundits and the apologists and all these people. I'm not going to do that because logically I know it makes no sense. And I made a conscious step away from it. And the more I did that, the easier it became. It was like exercising a muscle. The more I exercised the muscle, the stronger it got. And this is true with so many other things. Prejudices I didn't even realize I had. Like I was raised in a white bread, corn-fed Midwestern home where on the surface, in the lessons they told us, the lip service they gave us, the scripture verses they taught us, the color of your skin doesn't matter. God only cares about the heart. This is the stuff they would say at the shallowest surfaces of these conversations. But I'll tell you, looking back now, let's say I'd been a junior in high school and I told my parents, you know, I met and fell in love with someone and I'm taking her to prom. Of course, we didn't have prom in my Christian school. We called it a banquet and there was no dancing because dancing is, well, a vertical expression of a horizontal desire. That's a whole other show. So I'm going to bring her home and I'd like to introduce her to you. And they'd be like, oh, that's wonderful. Oh, that's amazing. If I had brought her home and she had been black, what would the response have been? Well, on the surface, you know, the message was skin color doesn't matter. But when it came to living our lives, when it wasn't just lip service, would it have mattered? I really do think it would have. We didn't have black friends. We didn't know a lot of black people. We didn't connect in that way beyond our tribe of middle-class white Oklahomans. And so it wasn't an overt kind of racism. It was something under the surface. It was really a double standard. I mean, we'd say all the time, well, the color of your skin doesn't matter. God cares about the heart. But if we went to a restaurant and you saw a mixed-race couple sitting in the booth, it was weird. Well, why was it weird? Because a lesson, a message, an attitude had been taught even beyond the words that came out of people's mouths, the way they treated other people, the way they perceived, and the way they taught us to do so, it affected how we saw the world. And often then they would frame it in this way. They would say, oh, you know, it's fine for those two to have fallen in love together. This is somebody in my culture. I mean, I don't know if it's any specific person, but I can totally hear this conversation. They would frame it like this. They'd say, oh, I mean, they're adults, they can be in love, and I think that's, you know, that's wonderful for them, but I just feel so bad for the children. A little mixed-race child who's going to be made fun of and bullied and ridiculed. His entire childhood is going to be marked by discrimination, and it's just so sad that they would do that to the child. So in this way, you judge the couple for setting a child up for bullying and ridicule. And in that way, they say, you know, it would be so much easier if the black person fell in love with the black person and the white person fell in love with the white person. These are the kinds of sort of subversive attitudes that are in many ways, not even through language, but in many ways taught or reinforced in people as you grow up. And so as I came out of religious thinking, you know, I would see a mixed race couple and I had to make a conscious choice. I literally had to stop and do a forensic examination of where that had come from. I said, why in the world would you blink twice at it beyond, hey, that's amazing and good for them and I hope they love the hell out of each other kind of thing? Why would you ever stop and look at people with different skin colors or different dress or backgrounds or whatnot? Why would it ever give you pause? Why is that there? And the more I understand where it had come from, I can rationally then purposefully take a step toward the better idea, the better notion of equality beyond skin color, to understand that we are all Africans, that we're all the human animal, and that love is love, and good for you guys. You have every right to be who you are. I think your love is beautiful. I think you both are beautiful. Good for you. I mean, you take that conscious step and decide, I'm not going to be chained to the baggage that I'm dragging from my older life. My best friend came out to me as gay. I did a whole speech about it. You know, you can look it up on my YouTube page. But, you know, I had wrestled with in my gut a lack of understanding about how a man could be attracted to a man, because I don't really relate to that. I'm a heterosexual guy. I'm attracted to women. I don't understand it. It doesn't really resonate in my bones. And I make the conscious choice. Now, as a rationalist, I'm like, well, who gives a shit whether or not I can relate to it? Who gives a shit whether or not I'm attracted to a man? Who gives a shit at whether or not I'm wired in this specific way or not? The truth is that this other person is. And it's perfectly natural, and it's beautiful, and it's something that needs to be supported and fought for. Love is love, again, right? And my rational brain allows me to step in the right direction toward better ideas. And that, again, strengthens the muscle. That, again, allows the next time to be easier and easier and easier, until I'm at a point now where I love being an advocate for non-heterosexual people. I love supporting love as part of the human condition in whatever context that you decide you want to frame it in your life. Live and be happy. It drives my religious family crazy, I think. I think it just drives them nuts. I think it drives my parents crazy that my best friend is gay. You know, you're not going to go down there and spend the weekend, are you? Like, I might become infected with gay. I mean, to be able to step past those horrible ideas and to make the conscious choice that I know this is irrational. I know this is stupid. I know it's based in damaging mythology and prejudice and discrimination and just small thinking. And I will purposefully walk the other direction. I'm going to take a step the other direction. A mind over heart exercise that actually does help to sort of retrain the brain. I mean, many people don't understand the power of indoctrination and how otherwise good people can drag along this baggage of really bad ideas, this stuff that they've been carrying with them for decades of their lives, and they didn't even realize that they were doing it, or they brushed it off, or they excused it, or whatever. Human beings are capable of rationalizing the irrational. The first step for me was to take a good hard look, recognize what it is, and then kick it to the curb. Just physically walk away. Sometimes if I see a perspective that I know is wrong and it still kind of scares me, I will purposefully, at that moment, move 180 degrees away from it and take an action that is contradictory to it as an exercise of control in my own life. This will not govern my life. I am no longer chained to it. I will be better. It's, I think, a healthy exercise for human beings to be able to do that. So in my opinion, and I'm not a psychologist, but if you're wrestling with those types of things in your own life, analyze what they are, where they came from, what are the roots of them. Do they make sense in light of the larger human condition, in light of our own system of ethics, under the lights of science? Do they make sense as part of the human condition? And if they're irrational, we can actually understand, we can realize that, and we can purposefully exercise mind over heart and take a step in the right direction toward better attitudes and ideas. That was my solution. Like, Corey and I didn't lose a year of our friendship because he was gay. Corey and I lost a year of our friendship because I realized I was a bigot. He wasn't the problem. I was the problem. When I walked into a room or a situation and I felt discomfort in my heart, in the church we used to say, in my spirit, I felt uncomfortable in my spirit. Why was that? Was the problem them? Was the problem me? 9 times out of 10, the problem was me. I had damaged attitudes and ideas about the world I was interacting with, and I had to adjust me. I had to fix me because they weren't broken. You can come to that point in your life. It's a liberating and wonderful place to be. Diane sent me a message. She said, I saw you a couple of years ago in Charlotte. I've been thinking about something you said. You talked about the dilution of religion towards atheism. That is, as time progresses, religions will actually evolve or devolve into more moderate versions of themselves or morph into something else, New Age or spiritual. I think this would be an interesting discussion. How people are reluctant to take that final step and give up that last bit of relief. And are these shreds of religion as detrimental as a more defined religion. Well, we may have to do a show on that. I would much rather have deists around me than theists. I'm not nearly as bothered by the I'm not religious, but I am spiritual people. Quite frankly, those people are very passive in terms of passing legislation and infecting science textbooks and indoctrinating children. Quite often, they just hold a warm, fuzzy belief about something out there. There are some people who are proactive, theocratic, global missionaries, and they're out there pounding at the pulpit and scaring people with hell and trying to sell a Ken Ham version of the creation of the world. These people are much more dangerous in my mind than those who are at the other end of the spectrum who just think, I think there's something out there somewhere. It is an interesting thing to watch people step away from fundamentalism. And this is the scale I think I used when I was speaking in Charlotte, Diane. Someone's a fundamentalist. Let's say I'm a fundamentalist, okay? I'm a true blue Bible believer. The Bible's literally true. And then maybe I listen to the show we did last week, which brings up some pretty problematic stuff. You know, the wedding dowry of foreskins and the execution of babies and slavery and all that. And so then I say, well, you know, maybe some of it was for yesterday and some of it's for today. Not all the Bible's relevant for today. Maybe I go deeper into some of this stuff, and then I say, well, only part of it is literal. Part of the Bible is metaphor. They're stories that we're supposed to learn from. They're parables. And then maybe I look into the historicity of Scripture and how we can't validate who wrote any of the books and how they clash against science and the evidence. And I say, well, I'm a Christian, but I don't necessarily hold to the Bible. Now, this is a fun one for me. The Bible is the foundational book for all of Christianity, which tells the story of human origins and the Jesus story. This is the blueprint. This is the foundation for all of Christianity. I say, I don't buy the Bible, but I'm a Christian. This has always been a weird one for me. And then I go a little further off the reservation and I say, well, you know, I believe in Jesus, not the angry Jesus. My Jesus is different. So now I'm giving Jesus characteristics that I have ascribed to him. Like I'm painting Jesus with my own brush. Well, you know, Jesus may not be the only God. Maybe there are some other gods or Jesus is those gods. I'm stepping further and further and further away from the center of my own faith until finally I come to a point where I say, I think there's something out there. I think there's a God, and he'd never send us to hell, and he's not going to judge us, and he doesn't really interact in our lives. I just, you know, something made the universe. Something's out there. You know, I see complex things, and I see patterns, and there's a lot of beautiful stuff, rainbows and pretty birds and beautiful babies born, and it's all overwhelming to me. I think there must be there's someone, something out there somewhere. And people like to drift in that little zone for the rest of their lives because the implications of taking the next step are pretty serious. If you take another step, you start to say, maybe there's not someone or something out there. And that's terrifying for a whole lot of people. The idea that there may not be a master plan, everything may not happen for a reason. There may not be a grand design. There may not be somebody else in control. People like to lean on authority figures. What happens if it's just us? It's scary. Some people are so desperate for a reunion in some happy place after they die that the idea of letting go of that happy place, right? If you let go of God, you let go of heaven. You let go of the afterlife. You let go of this reunion with your spouse, your children, your grandfather, your grandmother, your best friend, the people you loved and lost in this life. I mean, that's hugely attractive to a lot of people. It's terrifying to lose that. And so they just drift in this sort of deistic membrane for the rest of their lives. And those people are largely not the people who are running for public office on a religious platform. They're not pining for taxpayer money to pay for religious schooling and homeschooling. Climbing over and dancing on the church state wall. Most of the time, the people that I've met who live in that deistic area, they don't go to church. They don't really care too much about specific religious teachings or beliefs. They just occasionally wear God on their lapel like someone might wear an awareness ribbon. Now, it looks pretty. It makes you happy. It doesn't really mean much. Doesn't really change anything, but it's there and I'll wear it. That's how a lot of these people live. I mean, I do find the psychology of it interesting, the fact that people are often so reluctant to take those final steps, because in my mind, I think if you can take your steps away from those final steps out of a belief in an other with a capital O out there, it allows you even more to be able to focus on the human condition. Our fellow brothers and sisters here on planet Earth, human problems to human solutions. You can really focus on the real world. And I find it tragic that so many people are desperate to stay locked inside magical thinking when they don't have to. You don't have to have that. You don't have to believe in an afterlife to enjoy this life. You don't have to believe you will have a reunion with your loved ones to love and enjoy your loved ones. You don't have to believe there was a grand creator in the universe to be able to feel awe and wonder about the universe. In fact, many times superstitious magical thinking cheats us of the opportunities we have to really be the best we can be in this life. I guess I've blathered on enough for this broadcast. Just talk about random. Just a random show. Hopefully it's been enjoyable to listen to. Thanks for being here. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being such a positive part of my life. Thank you for reminding me that I am not alone in my skepticism of religion. I bitch and moan a lot about family, the religious family. It probably gets old to hear, but I mean, you have no idea how important and amazing it is to be able to be among fellow skeptics. You know, to be able to take the journey along with other people who are, you know, they're taking that step I talked about away from the irrational parts of ourselves and toward better ideas and trying to live with less judgment, you know, more acceptance, more love, better ideas about the human condition, the rejection of these damaging mythologies and these things that were designed to chain people, keep them in a box, you know, to be able to be a part of a movement, despite its flaws, to be a part of a movement that's doing that kind of thing is... it's huge for me to be part of a family of people who can all come together. I mentioned I'm preparing this speech. In fact, I'm about to jump right back into the preparation of this speech for my California run for Los Angeles coming up in August. But for any of the events coming up, you know, I'm going to be in St. Louis in just a few days. And we've got Louisville, Kentucky and Orlando, Florida, some other stuff to be able to come together with people who are fellow skeptics. Many of those people have commonalities with me and how they sort of escaped these damaging dogmas and all this insanity. And now we can all come together and we can sort of laugh about it. We can high five and hug and we can support each other in our commitments to trying to be better people, live better lives, pursue better ideas, hopefully have a better future. I mean, that's huge for me. So thank you. Thanks for everything you are and do for me and for others in the Thinking Atheist community. It is huge. Have a wonderful week, and I'll see you back here next Tuesday as we do it all over again on the Thinking Atheist Radio Podcast. Take care.
Follow the Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on the Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.